Gallatin Valley. This is Body Politic on KGVM Bozeman 95.9 FM. I'm your host, Dr. Nurse Nancy. Our producer is Robin Fly. Today's show actually is about some aspects of nursing, and more specifically, about some concerns that have occurred to me as I've gone about my nursing duties for hospice patients and with residents of assisted living facilities. In the second half of the show, we'll be talking about working conditions for caregivers in assisted living facilities and other care settings and how that affects patient care. In this first half of the show, we're going to focus on supporting people at the end of life who may want to hasten their own death. I should point out that medical aid in dying is legal in Montana for terminally ill, mentally competent adults, but it can be hard to get. In some parts of the state, there aren't physicians willing to prescribe medication to hasten death. So even though assisted dying is legal, it isn't always available. But even if there are willing physicians in your part of the state, you may not qualify. For example, you generally have to be able to self-administer your own medication, which basically means that you have to drink it or give it to yourself through a feeding tube. For some patients, such as patients with ALS, this can be difficult or impossible because you can't move your muscles well. Other patients might have a progressive and incurable disease, and they might decide as a quality of life issue that they are no longer willing to live with the effects of the disease and its progression. But if doctors don't think that the disease is going to cause death within 6 months, those patients can't get medical aid in dying because they're not considered terminal. So what are these patients to do, and what can Montana learn from other places? Well, if we look at some European countries, for example, we learn that different laws can address these challenges. In some European countries, a patient who can't self-administer medication, such as an ALS patient, can receive medication from a doctor. They don't have to self-administer. And in some cases, a patient doesn't have to prove that they are terminally ill. They can sometimes receive assistance, even if they aren't expected to die within 6 months. In most states in the U.S., on the other hand, medical aid in dying is against the law. Today, we're going to be talking with Judy Schwartz, clinical director at End of Life Choices New York, where medical aid in dying is not legal yet. We're going to start by hearing a 9-minute excerpt of a presentation Judy gave over Zoom on voluntary stopping eating and drinking, or VSED. Voluntary stopping eating and drinking is a method of hastening death that is not illegal in any state, so it can be used by patients in Montana who want to hasten death but who can't access medical aid in dying. VSED is intended to be used only by people who are mentally competent and who have a terminal or progressive and incurable illness, and of course it should never be coerced. Let's listen to what's involved.
What is VSED? It's important that everybody be on the same page about what this means. Voluntarily stopping eating and drinking is a decision to deliberately hasten death by stopping all oral intake. We're talking about food and fluid here. While the person is still physically able to eat and drink, it is an intentional and voluntary choice by a decisionally capable person who suffers intolerably, and they get to define what that means, from an incurable, progressive, or terminal illness. And the goal of doing so is to hasten their death. This is different from the loss of appetite that often is experienced by dying persons as death nears. And I can tell you it's rarely anybody's first choice, but often there are no good legal options to hasten death. So I think it's also important that we define what a successful VSED outcome is and how is success defined. And this is my definition. A successful outcome is a peaceful death with a minimum of discomfort, which occurs within a predictable period of time, and that can be days or weeks. Not knowing and uncertainty is very, very challenging to deal with. The cause of death is dehydration, not starvation. And VSAD is legally available in all states if the person who makes this choice is decisionally capable and makes a voluntarily, i.e. uncoerced, informed and contemporaneous choice. So here are the four ingredients that are necessary. They need to be in place for a successful VSAD death. The first is a decisionally capable suffering patient who is very determined to hasten death by fasting. That person must understand the process, know what to expect, and have concluded that the burdens of living consistently outweigh the benefits of continued life. And I should say, this option is not for everyone. Nobody can do this for you. You have to take charge yourself. The second ingredient is the need for social and caregiving support. So you need to have family members or close friends who will journey along with you and understand why you've made this choice. The caregiving support ends up usually being 24/7 because you will end up in bed and you need to be well cared for while you are in bed. The third thing that's necessary for success is access to hospice or palliative medical oversight. This cannot be forgotten. It's absolutely crucial. You can't do this alone. You need to have help from caregiving support and hospice or palliative care physicians or clinicians. And the fourth thing that's necessary is all involved with this decision must have patience with the process. So what are the challenges to a peaceful VSAD death? For those with a terminal illness, which means the definition of that is some physician's guesstimate that you'll die within the next 6 months. For those folks who are in a terminal state and nearing death, foregoing food usually is not difficult because your appetite is diminished. You're really just not hungry at all. Foregoing fluids can be challenging. There's no doubt about it. But with good basic nursing care, bedside aids, providing good oral care, rinsing and spitting, the fine spray sprayed on the back of your throat, toothbrushing, mouthwash, anything that helps relieve the feeling of a dry mouth will indeed help you tolerate that kind of thing. In addition, the use of small doses of opiates or an anti-anxiety medication will facilitate a sleepy state. The usual length of the fast is 7 to 14 days. The average for people who are terminally ill is about 10 days. If fluids are significantly limited, ideally, you stop all fluids because that's what's crucial here, is stopping all fluids. And if the patient is terminally ill, often the patient will slip into a coma during the final days of the fast. So it's important to stress that family and caregivers will also need support. As the patient continues to forego fluids, they will go into organ failure, and that's a process that occurs over some time, which can cause the patient to be confused or occasionally agitated or suffer from delirium. Hospice clinicians can and will provide medication to address those symptoms, to relieve those symptoms. The other thing that's very important is before starting a VSAD process, the patient, the family members, and the caregivers must discuss how the patient wants their caregivers and family to respond in case the patient asks for or seems to want fluids. Once they've lost decision-making capacity and they've no doubt then forgotten their plan to hasten their death. So this should be discussed ahead of time, and the patient can say, well, give me little bits to make me more comfortable if I seem to be uncomfortable, or alternatively, they may say, give me nothing, just give me more medication so that I'm sleepy and I don't experience anything. This is an important discussion that needs to happen before the patient embarks upon this process, because after several days, possibly the end of the first week, patient will not be able to make informed choices. So the goal should be, if you're giving fluids to provide comfort, you provide the least amount of fluid possible to provide comfort while reminding the patient of what their plan was initially, which was to hasten their death. So there are more challenges when the patient is not terminally ill. For one thing, it can be difficult to obtain palliative medical oversight. Sometimes the primary care physician will order medications and provide that palliative management. And other times, a patient must begin to fast for several days at home before the family or the doctor will contact hospice to say, "Mom's dying, and I don't know what to do, and I need some help here. Will you come and help us?" And usually hospice will step in then, realizing that the patient is close to death. In the absence of a terminal illness, fasting can be more challenging, and it can last longer, sometimes up to 3 weeks rather than the 10 days. There must be no question, though, that the patient's suffering has become intolerable and the decision to escape is voluntarily made and well-informed. So there occasionally are ethical issues that are raised by clinicians and other caregivers who are providing support for somebody who's chosen to stop eating and drinking. Some may question whether providing VSAID support is morally equivalent to assisting in a suicide. Somebody who stops eating and drinking is causing their death, and technically speaking, I suppose one could call that suicide. On the other hand, one has dominion over one's own body, and if you decide not to put something in it to hasten your death, that's fine too. It's like any other life-prolonging measure, in my view. So those who believe it's always morally wrong for a person to hasten death may hold that providing information or support for VSAID is also immoral, and they get to make that decision. Healthcare professionals are not obliged to provide care they find morally objectionable. However, claims of conscience permit withdrawing from a case, but not abandoning a patient or not providing transfer to somebody who will tell them about options that they're legally able to make.
This is Body Politic on KGVM Bozeman 95.9 FM. I'm your host, Dr. Nurse Nancy. We've just heard a clip of Judy Schwartz, clinical director at End of Life Choices New York, explaining what is involved in voluntary stopping eating and drinking to hasten death. We'll put a link to this clip on the KGVM website. Judy is joining us now via Zoom to talk about a related issue and also possibly more about VSAID. Judy is a PhD prepared nurse. She's been a nurse for more than 50 years, and she has researched and written extensively on end-of-life issues. Welcome, Judy.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So did you want to, before we launch into the next topic, advanced directives for people with dementia, did you want to add anything about VSAID and our perspectives on that?
I think it's important that folks understand that VSAID is an option for any decisionally capable individual. You don't have to have any particular kind of disease. You can just decide, and I get a lot of calls from folks who say, "I'm done. I'm just done." And they're, it's not that they have a disease. It's not that they're incurably and progressively ill. They're just done. And they want to know how they can, if they choose, be in charge of their own end of life. So I just want to be sure that people understand that, generally speaking, because this takes a resolute and determined individual, there usually is some kind of experience of suffering that has become unbearable to that person. But that can also be existential, like, "I'm done, I'm finished. Why do I have to continue to endure?" So I just thought that was an important addition that I wanted to be sure people understood.
It is, and I really appreciate that very much. And in fact, some of the research I've looked at, mostly in Europe, but perhaps it applies here as well, among reasons people might choose to hasten their own death is exactly as you said. I think often there they call it weariness of life. Mm-hmm. It's like, mm-hmm. you know, I'm done. My friends aren't here anymore. I can't do the things I used to do, and I'm ready to move on. So thank you.
Exactly. And those are the reasons, I'm sure you know as well, that folks in Oregon and Washington, states that have a long history of supporting medical aid in dying, it's not about pain. Pain can be managed. That's not the issue. But it's the meaninglessness of having to continue to endure when you cannot do the things that used to give you pleasure.
Exactly.
That's why people raise this issue and consider it very strong.
Yeah. Thank you. So I'd like to change the topic a little and address the problem of dementia when it comes to people being able to decide how long and in what condition they want to live. So in the Netherlands, when a patient is first diagnosed with dementia, as long as she is still of sound mind overall, she can write an advanced healthcare directive asking to receive medical aid in dying when her disease progresses to a certain point, and such directives have been honored there. But that kind of advanced directive is not available in the U.S. And so this has led some organizations, including End of Life Choices New York, to come up with a different kind of advanced directive, one that focuses on eating and drinking. And Judy, we'll talk in a minute very specifically about what's in these directives, but let's start by talking about what you have seen happen when people don't have these kind of directives in place. And now they're maybe in a memory care facility and you can take
Then they're screwed.
They're screwed.
If I may say.
Yeah.
Because I get calls all the time from usually it's the daughters of an elderly parent who is indeed in a long-term care facility in a memory wing, and they're completely demented. They have no ability to make decisions, and yet that reflex, that very primitive rooting reflex, right, that when a spoon is put to the mouth pops open like a baby bird's.
Right.
And the glop is put in the mouth, and the person, gums it and chews it and swallows it.
And it usually is glop, I will say.
Oh, it is glop. Absolutely.
Pureed glop.
We're not even talking scrambled eggs and bagels. We're talking glop.
Yeah.
And the thing is that if it's properly done and carefully provided, people can live for years that way.
Mm-hmm.
They will just be given spoonfuls of fluid and spoonfuls of glop. From very patient and well-trained providers, aides often, and it can go on forever. Now, it's important to say that for some people, that's fine, that's a perfectly acceptable experience. They don't think anybody should hasten their death. They don't want their death hastened. And so long as they're not in pain, they're quite happy to endure. And that's fine. That's the default position unless you very carefully and specifically write alternative instructions and also have a very well-informed healthcare agent who will advocate for you. So we need to be clear that people have every right to make a choice that reflects their values and wishes, those of their families, their religion, whatever it is that drives those decisions is perfectly fine. Our goal, and I'm sure is yours as well, we want folks making informed decisions, which means they understand the consequences of the choice they've made, they understand the alternatives, and they really are able to give some thought to why they're making this choice. So what I found in the work that I do here in New York is all of a sudden I was getting calls from people who didn't have cancer, didn't have end-stage ALS. They'd just been diagnosed with an early stage of dementia, which, as you know, is occurring earlier and earlier in this disease because they're much better at diagnosing early. They believe that benefits patients. There might be some treatments that are more effective in the very early stages of dementia, although sadly, as we know, there's no cure and no effective treatment at this point. Nonetheless, so I was getting calls from these people who were absolutely horrified at what they saw for themselves coming down the road, that they had they didn't understand or they feared there was nothing they could do to shorten that dying process. Mm-hmm. So then often, you know, they'd been visiting a grandparent in a nursing home and they saw the alternative and they didn't want to have to be a body in diapers in a bed without knowing who they were, what they had been, and who they are now. So those were the calls I started to get. And that's what drove the need to have some kind of a documentation, a document that would allow these people to say, okay, if I reach the point, and there are two aspects of this, right? The first is you've lost decision-making capacity. You just cannot make informed and thoughtful healthcare decisions for yourself. That's number one. Number two, you no longer can adequately feed yourself, right? You can't physically manipulate the spoon, the food. You can't get enough food or fluid into your system, into your mouth, into your body to sustain life. So those two things have to be present. And that's when the healthcare agent, together with the primary care physician, agree that now it's time to look at these instructions that were left that have to do specifically with eating and drinking. Shall
yeah.
I say more about it?
Well, I will tell you, I personally had a case not that long ago that was exactly as you described. The patient was essentially bedbound. Certainly no communication was going on, but she would open your mouth if you put a spoon in front of her.
Of course.
And
yeah.
apparently
yeah.
this patient and her daughter, prior to the development of such advanced dementia, had several explicit conversations with the patient saying, I don't want to be spoon-fed, but they never mm-hmm. put it in writing. And the daughter
right.
pleaded with the
yep.
memory care staff.
Yep.
And they said, look, there's nothing we can do. There's nothing in writing. We have to feed her. And
I mean, that's the thing. How can you withhold oral intake from somebody who appears to be willing to be fed?
Right.
How can you not do that? That both legally and morally, how can you not do that? And that's therein lies the conundrum. Because people that work in long-term care facilities feel both legally and clinically bound to continue to feed those of their residents who seem to be willing to be fed.
Absolutely. So let's go ahead and talk about specifically what is in these directives and how people can use them.
Right. So what we did in New York is... we gave folks that were interested in stipulating the limitations they wanted on oral feeding in the future when they lost decision-making capacity and could no longer feed themselves, two options. One option is the stop everything. I don't care. I want nothing by mouth. I do, and I don't want any other life-prolonging measures, of course. No CPR, no antibiotics, no IVs, nothing else. I do want aggressive symptom management. I want aggressive palliative care. I don't want to suffer as a result of this choice, but I want nothing by mouth, period. So that's option A. The other, and I'll tell you, that's very hard for family members to honor, even though they know this is what mom or dad or grandpa wanted. If you've got somebody who may be hungry or thirsty, and they can't tell you with words, but they seem to be uncomfortable or suffering, or they're moving their mouth in a way that indicates that their mouth is dry, how can you not respond to that? And so that's why the second option, which is comfort feeding, is so important, because I know from the work that I do with people that even when a patient makes a well-informed choice to not have any food or fluid, and when they say to their families, just ignore me if I tell you I'm hungry, just pay no attention to me if I say I'm thirsty, very hard to do.
Yeah.
Very hard to do. So to have another option, which is comfort feeding only, which means that we no longer care about balancing the green glop with the brown glop. Mm-hmm. We don't care about maintaining weight. All we want is this person to feel comforted by little bits of something or other in their mouth that seem to soothe them and please them. If it's only chocolate pudding, they always like vanilla pudding. They love that rice pudding. That's what you give them. You don't force them. You don't coerce them. You don't encourage them to have more. You just give them little bits of whatever seems to give them comfort. So the process takes longer, perhaps, than going without anything by mouth. But it is a much easier process for family members and caregivers to support.
Yeah.
So those are the two options.
Okay.
And so, also good palliative care in both cases.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we are coming to the end of our first half hour, but I did want to say we're going to be putting up links on our website to the advanced care directives that you all have developed. Just as a last question I'd like to ask, you and I discussed this a little bit yesterday, but I can see many benefits to this, but have these been tested in court yet?
No, they haven't. They haven't gone before a judge yet, and I presume that in time they will. Our position is that it's like any other advanced directive that is completed by a decisionally capable, informed person that is saying, this is a life-prolonging measure that I no longer will benefit from at this particular time. Clearly, food and fluid, however it's provided, is a medical intervention that is keeping this person alive. And we know well that the Supreme Court has ruled that you have a right to decide what gets put into your body, however it's put in, whether it's by IV or by a spoon. Rehnquist himself said that. So we're pretty confident that in most settings, but not all, this will be recognized as an absolute right that a decisionally capable person has to make to decide they don't want this life-prolonging measure.
Well, Judy Schwartz, thank you so much for joining us. We will be putting a link to End of Life Choices New York and to these directives. And finally, you were part of a team that wrote a book on voluntary stopping eating and drinking.
Yeah, and it's a very good resource if you want a deep dive into voluntarily stopping eating and drinking. As a matter of fact, it was published by Oxford University Press last year. The title of the book is Voluntarily Stopping Eating and Drinking, a Compassionate, Widely Available Option for Hastening Death. And I, along with three colleagues, co-edited this book. And in addition to 2/3 of it being about a decisionally capable choice to stop eating and drinking, the remaining third is about completing an advanced directive to stop eating and drinking. So it's an awfully good resource. So as I say, it's Oxford University Press, and it was published last year, 2021. So good luck. And then they were out of it for a while ago. I don't know whether they've reprinted it, because we do have, you know, the supply side issues.
Yeah.
I understand.
Yeah. And a lot of people want to know. Well, Judy, thank you so much.
My pleasure. If people have questions, you know, you can send them to me by email, because if you go to our website, you'll see that my name is there, and I can give you my email if you'd like. It's judith@endoflifechoicesny.org. judith@endoflifechoicesny.org. Send me your questions and I'll try and answer them for you.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.